If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Animal Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Callie Smith, a host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking with Anita Guarini about her book, Experimenting with Humans and Animals, From Aristotle to CRISPR. As a warning, this conversation will include discussion of human and animal suffering. In this book, Guarini traces the long history of human and animal experimentation in the West. She states, "My purpose in writing this book is not to resolve any of these issues or to project current moral sensibilities back on historical actors, but to provide readers with the materials to understand their history and therefore understand their present. Animal and human experimentation are unlikely to disappear in the foreseeable future, but discussion of these values that dictate policies for its conduct must come from an informed public." Anita Guarini, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Callie. I really appreciate it.
Of course, we're delighted. So you're actually a returning guest to the podcast. You last spoke with us in 2015 about your book, The Courtier's Anatomist, Animals and Humans in Louis XIV's Paris. But you've had a busy past few years, I'm assuming, getting this second edition together. So what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Oh, well, so I retired at the end of 2018 and spent most of 2019 in Europe doing research, which was really nice. So it's kind of my retirement sabbatical. And then I came back and in 2020, I spent January teaching an intercession course at Colby College and came back in February and just in time for COVID. So most of 2020, like everybody else, I was locked down at home and kind of looking for something to do in some ways. I mean, I had lots of projects, but I knew that a lot of people were still using the first edition of this book, and it was kind of dated. A lot of things had happened in between. I had published things that I kind of wished I had included in the book, including things on, you know, ecological science. And I was at Oregon State for 10 years, which is an ag school, and was on the IACUC there, the Animal Care and Use Committee, and realized there's a whole slew of research on rangeland animals, on farm animals that I had didn't really know much about when I wrote the first edition of this book 20 years ago, and I thought I should include that too. So I wrote to the editor at Johns Hopkins, who had published the first edition, a different editor because the first editor had retired, and said, hey, are you interested in a second edition? And he said, yes, we are, very enthusiastically. So that's what I spent 2020 working on, kind of in with great consciousness of COVID and of the role animals played in developing the COVID vaccine in particular, but just kind of how epidemics figured into all this. So so I finished this pretty much at the end of 2020, spent 2021 doing the revisions and getting the illustrations and all those things. And then it just came out this past August.
That's wonderful. I'll have to say, yeah, one reason that really grabbed my attention for wanting to read this book and to talk with you is, of course, the pandemic and the development of the vaccine. And actually, from where I live, 15 minutes down the road, is a primate testing facility. So, yeah. So, and as someone who chose to get vaccinated and you know, really thought the benefits were worth it, it still really weighs on me, of course, the animal lives and the human lives that were involved as well. So, so thank you for creating an updated edition. I was reading some Amazon comments, and I think there were some students saying, assigned for a course, a must read. So I know there'll be many others out there who will benefit from this new edition. So returning to just the general concept of the book, why humans and animals together?
Yeah, when I wrote the first edition, I thought, and this was back in the late 90s, I thought I would just do it on animals because I had been teaching a course for quite a while at UC Santa Barbara on the history of animals and science, basically. And my editor at Johns Hopkins, who Bob Brueger at the time, said, no, I think you should look at both animals and humans. And I hadn't worked on human experimentation at all. So that was new for me, but I'm really glad that he suggested that because they do kind of go together. You can't really have one without the other.
No, that's great. And I think, you know, even though we call this an animal studies channel and most of the books really are looking solely at animals, the human's never out of it, you know, because we're the ones writing it. But especially, I think it's interesting, you know, as you say, the conversation really isn't between science and ethics, it's science and the social pressure surrounding that. Can you say more about how society has really shaped the course of experimentation?
Well, I think, let me think about that a bit. So looking back historically, both animals and certain classes of humans were simply considered open territory for us to use in any way we felt fit. And that includes, you know, enslaved people, but also at various times, children, women, handicapped people, and so forth. So I think acknowledging how those standards changed over time is important. Figuring out, but also on the other hand, figuring out what we learned from these kinds of experimenting. Sometimes really great things, sometimes things that turned out not to really be relevant. And how that's become ingrained in how we do science, that we do biological science basically based on standards that were developed, you know, 500 years ago, that animal and human experimentation is just part of how we do it. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but I'm saying that we should acknowledge that that's how science has been done and that's how it's developed historically over time in the West.
And returning to, you know, who has been experimented on historically, you have a really important discussion about categories such as vile bodies and people being classified as monsters. And so this includes, people who were deemed disposable or of least value. And you identified some of those groups like enslaved persons, women, orphans. Is there anything else you'd like to add about those distinctions and how, even if we think we have hoped to overcome them more recently, how they still sort of haunt us?
Yeah, the concept of vile bodies is from a French author named Grégoire Chamaillou, who wrote a really interesting book called Vile Bodies, Les Corps Vils, about 15 years ago, at least. And the idea is that you have to kind of classify someone as vile before you think you can do these kinds of things to them. So either humans or animals. He's talking mainly about humans.
And when you were saying something about like you have to label something as vile in order to experiment on it, it made me think of another point you make about whenever James Juran started using numbers.
Oh, statistics, yeah.
Yeah, statistics, and how that's kind of also been built into this like depersonalization.
Absolutely. And that was, I mean, his use of statistics, which is based on basically game theory, was very important in promoting the use of inoculation and then later vaccination and other development of other vaccines, that you show that you can demonstrate that people who were inoculated in that period in the 18th century with smallpox died less from fewer of them died from smallpox than people who just caught smallpox naturally. And that was really convincing, the idea that numbers were convincing. But in order to do that, then you're not thinking of people as individuals, you're thinking of people as units, as statistical units. And that's become, you know, that's really the basis of science. I've just been writing something on the kind of polio pioneers in the 1950s, the children who first tested the Salk vaccine in 1954. And again, they wanted statistical proof that this existed. So they gave the vaccine to, you know, hundreds of thousands of children with their parents' consent. And it wasn't obviously about the individual children, except to their parents. It was about the statistical proof that this vaccine was effective. So when the numbers were crunched, and this was before there were really, you know, big computers to do this, and it took almost a year to crunch the numbers, then it came out that the vaccine was 80 to 90% effective against polio. So that is a really good example, though, of the kind of depersonalization of it. Each individual child certainly knew they were being part of this, and their parents were conscious of the individuality of their children, but we didn't have anybody's names in the final report in April 1955 that, yes, this polio vaccine works, and here's, you know, 600,000 children who tried it. So that, and that's just kind of how, because statistical proof has become really important in experimentation, it doesn't take account of the individual. The individual.
Thank you for that.
A number.
Yeah. And I do want to jump back in a moment to the beginning of the book, because I would love to give listeners a sense of like we began, you know, 2,300 years ago to the present. But since you mentioned polio and the rush and really this like the acceptance kind of on the part of parents, like, hey, we really need something. We're terrified of this. Like we want a vaccine for our families and even for ourselves. I'm wondering if you can say about, and I think you draw parallels in the book between how polio was tested and that process and maybe even the COVID vaccine. And obviously we have access to quicker tools for measuring statistics, but am I reading that correctly? Did you sort of make a parallel between the polio epidemic and then COVID?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, in both cases, there was this huge push to develop a vaccine. In the case of polio, particularly after World War II, partly because of, you know, the birth of baby boomers, that the post-war parents had a lot of kids, and there was a big polio epidemic in 1952. And polio was just this omnipresent fear. I mean, I kind of came in at the tail end of that. And even though there was a polio vaccine when I was, you know, in kindergarten, first grade, parents were still really afraid of polio. And everybody knew somebody who had polio. And I think COVID certainly invoked that kind of fear. And there was this huge push to develop a vaccine globally. In the case of polio, it was mostly in the United States that the vaccine development happened. There were some people elsewhere, but it was mostly in the United States. And in the case of COVID, though, it was a global effort because it was seen as a global disease. And vaccine development was much faster than with polio, partly because science changed. And there were, you know, all kinds of different kinds of vaccines. I mean, the polio vaccine is basically the same as Jenner's smallpox vaccine, basically a weaker version or a killed version of the virus. And the modern COVID vaccines are not that at all. They're quite different. They're based on the DNA and RNA of the virus. So, and DNA and RNA weren't actually known in the early 50s. So it's similar in the sense that there is a lot of public pressure. There was obviously the use of a lot of animals in the case of COVID, because it's more like flu. The animals that were used included ferrets and cats. Ferrets can get the flu, and ferrets turn out to be really good models for human respiratory viruses.
That fascinated me. Yeah, when I read that, I was like, wow, ferrets.
Yeah, ferrets. I mean, who knew? And the human testing was not on children, because I mean, polio is considered to be a childhood disease, although it wasn't entirely. But in COVID, the case of COVID, they were human volunteers, adult volunteers, who tested various vaccines in 2020 and 2021. It's funny. I don't know if you get this feeling, but kind of 2020 and 2021 are these kind of black holes.
So they are, yeah.
Technology gets kind of screwed up, but I mean, the vaccines first can't come out toward the end of 2021. In spring of 2021. So that entire time, from beginning in about March, April 2020, so very soon after the COVID was declared a pandemic, vaccine development began. And it was, because it was on multiple sites, there were lots of animals that were used to develop the COVID vaccine, lots of different animals. And human testing starts to take place toward the beginning of 2021 on adult volunteers.
And I know you don't address this specifically in the book, in terms of like, you mentioned the types of animals that are used for COVID, but when you said cats, I was thinking about this wider discussion throughout the book of domestic animals. And I think, was it like the 17th or maybe earlier 18th, 19th century? There was this belief that they could feel pain more because they were domesticated versus their wild counterparts. And dogs especially are just like this recurring animal throughout the text of kind of like, we don't really feel comfortable experimenting on these animals that live with us and share our space. So it's interesting, just going back to the COVID point, that's not talked about. Like, we know it's on animals, but like, where are these cats coming from? Like, are they breeding them for this purpose? Do they have genetically modified cats the way they do rats and mice?
No, that's a good question. I'm not sure there are genetically modified cats, but I could be totally wrong about that. I'm not sure where they get cats for this purpose. I'm guessing that they are bred, that there are breeding facilities because there are for dogs. But I don't actually know. I've never really investigated that. But cats also are pretty good models for respiratory viruses. Cats can get colds, and not all animals do. Ferrets can sneeze. Most animals don't sneeze.
That's fascinating.
So it's all, you know, all these considerations. So, I mean, in that case, rats are good in some ways, but rats don't sneeze and rats don't have certain characteristics that humans have, you know, in terms of spreading the virus or in terms of you know, respiratory viruses in general. Rats are not always very good models for that.
Since we've just mentioned rats and, you know, where do you get these things? This is like it's a long question forever, right? Like sourcing your research subject. And maybe this can be a chance where we hop back and give listeners a sense to the longer history. So yes, there was, whenever the text begins, it's 2,300 years ago, and you say it's this kind of window of time where the taboo of working with dead bodies or experimentation, it was less so. And so they can kind of, scientists, Aristotle researchers could kind of, or what we would call now researchers, would go in and started experimenting. I think it might be helpful, because it was for me as a reader, this distinction between demonstration, experimentation, and vivisection, because you provide really good glimpses of those things.
Demonstration, that would be showing something without like changing it. So you could demonstrate, say, the circulation of the blood, even just by showing that it exists, by not causing any changes. Experimentation is to kind of test that, to cause some, to challenge it. So you would, when Harvey is trying to prove the circulation of blood, he does experiments to prove that the blood circulates. So he goes in and he ties off vessels. He pokes a probe into a vein to show where the valves are, which is more of a demonstration in that case, because he's not causing anything to change. Whereas if you tie off a vessel, you're causing a change. And then you witness how that change shows you something else. This is a really awkward discussion. Vivisection was a very specific term that referred to surgical intervention. So most of what Harvey did, for example, was vivisection, because he would surgically intervene in an animal. He would cut an animal open to demonstrate the circulation of blood. But a lot of experiments on animals didn't involve any kind of surgical intervention. So all the stuff that Pasteur did, for example, to develop the rabies vaccine, he's injecting animals with the disease particles. So strictly speaking, that's not vivisection, because he's not surgically intervening. But vivisection has come to be a kind of blanket term for any kind of experimentation on animals or on humans. But the kind of, I mean, the literal meaning of it is to cut into an animal, to cut into something that is alive.
Thank you. I know that was a really technical discussion, but thank you. I found that really useful. Because I thought vivisection was just experiments on live animals. Mm-hmm. And so I thought your discussion really helped provide more background and context for me in that regard. You mentioned Harvey. So that's William Harvey from the 17th century, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was he the one who he dissected his father? Who was the one who did that?
His father was dead. He did the autopsy on his father.
Are there writings of him reflecting on that experiment?
No, I don't think so. And that wasn't really an experiment. It was just an autopsy. It was a demonstration. So I don't think he does any experiments on his father's body.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I misspoke. Yeah, but it was so interesting that that was before an audience.
Yes. And I think part of that was because there weren't that many subjects for autopsy at that time. Most people didn't want their bodies to be dissected after death, and particularly if you had the means to do so, you would, you know, you could ensure that that didn't happen. So the people who were dissected after death, there is no human vivisection at this point, tended to be poor people or criminals. So sometimes autopsies were done for, you know, for forensic purposes to determine the cause of death or something like that. And whoops, sorry, there's a helicopter going by.
No worries.
Wow, that's loud. So then you would have kind of more, you know, middle class or upper class subjects for autopsies, but not for kind of the dissection to just, you know, show what the body looks like. So when Harvey's father died, he decided to dissect him. And he did it, I believe, in front of the College of Physicians, where he did anatomy lectures. And I'm sure people at the time thought this was kind of callous, Harvey is such an interesting character because in many ways, you know, in print, he comes across as this kind of reasonable, modest kind of guy. But then it's like, wow, he's doing all this stuff. So, yeah.
And I think in the book you write how like Descartes gets more of the bad rap for being
Definitely.
This, but really Harvey, you're saying.
Harvey's doing it. Yeah, Descartes is not doing it.
He's just saying animal machine, but Harvey's maybe treating animals like machines or things to look at. Speaking of test subjects, I really want to jump to the three enslaved women in Alabama. And I'm really curious about just for any person who was deemed lesser than a vile body or like you're saying, you know, prisoners may have volunteered for their freedom, not volunteered, but they may have agreed to experimentations for the chance of freedom. And then in the case of these three women who went through like 30 gynecological operations, in terms of notes for groups who were abused, how were there individual stories available? Or how did you go about learning about the person?
Oh, well, the guy who did the gynecological experiments, Marion Sims, he published about these things. Other researchers have kind of done the work to find out who the women were and find out their names and so forth, because he certainly didn't publish that. But he was upheld for a long time as a pioneering surgeon who found out, you know, all these things about female anatomy and so forth, and a pioneer of gynecological surgery, which he was, but I mean, he did some pretty horrendous things to women, you know, without anesthesia. And the reason he could do it is because they were enslaved women. He couldn't do that on the, you know, his fellow whites in the South, but he could do it to women who were enslaved. And that's, yeah, now we look at that and it's like, bleh, that is horrible. And it was horrible. So, but on the other hand, he was upheld, as I said, as, you know, as a founder of gynecological surgery. And I'm not enough of a, you know, I'm not knowledgeable enough in medicine to know whether what he found out could not have been found out by other means or eventually or whatever, but that's what he did. And there was a statue to him until 2018 in New York. So, yeah.
Were the names of the women that he experimented on, Lucy, Anarka, and Betsy, and I'm assuming there were probably others as well, were those included in the primary source material that you may have looked at in his notes?
No, I didn't look at his notes, but I used secondary material, and they gave the names. There are researchers who have found out a lot more about this by looking at his manuscripts and I think contemporary accounts.
While we're talking about women, I was thinking about, especially with like gynecological research, was it Dr. Anna Kingsford, and then was it Bradford?
Blackwell, Elizabeth Blackwell.
Okay. So they, if I remember correctly, they were kind of the first ones to be like, hey, wasn't there some observation that they made about men testing on women's bodies?
Yes. And Anna Kingsford in particular compared this to vivisection. This was a period in the kind of last third of the 19th century when the kind of Victorian mores were really oppressive to women and women who were deemed to be, you know, quote unquote hysterical, were subject to having their clitorises cut out, to having hysterectomies because it was thought that it was the female organs that somehow made you crazy. And Anna Kingsford and Elizabeth Blackwell both were like, no, that's just no. Just no. So I don't know how else to say it. And Anna Kingsford in particular compared this to vivisection of animals, that this is, you know, the same thing. And if you're anti-vivisection, you have to be opposed to this as well. And there's a whole kind of mingling of women in the anti-vivisection movement, and there were a lot of women in the anti-vivisection movement, and then this kind of gynecological surgery that was going on at the same time. So it really made this kind of moral obligation more pressing because when she made that comparison. Some people thought she was kind of nuts, Anna Kingsford, because she did kind of put herself out there.
I think you're right that she even offered herself as a replacement for experiments on animals. Did anything come of that other than you follow up on, like, you know, her male colleagues was like, this confirms that she's overly emotional and hysterical.
Exactly. Nothing came of that. And Elizabeth Blackwell, was very important. Well, they were both physicians. Elizabeth Blackwell was the first American female physician who studied in New York, upstate New York. And she was seen as being less hysterical than Anna Kingsford, but they were saying many of the same things.
Anytime, you know, a woman appeared in the text, because of course, you know, history, very white, very male, I perked up. But I do think it was interesting to see how women also participated for harm, as well as in the case of the Princess of Wales, who paid for the inoculation of orphans at St. James. And you're like, oh, she's, you know, paying for orphans to be vaccinated. It's like, oh, but then you follow up and show... This was basically an experiment or a trial before she vaccinates her own kids.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's kind of presented as this charitable gesture. But on the other hand, yeah, it's totally an experiment. I mean, first they did it on prisoners and then they did it on orphans. And it's like, okay, and then I will vaccinate my child, which I have to say, Mary Wortley Montagu just went ahead and vaccinated her children, her inoculated, I should say, her children before any of these experiments were done.
So. Her story was really fascinating too. You write that she was the ambassador for Constantinople.
She was the wife.
We could hope, right, that she would be.
1718. There are no female ambassadors, I'm afraid.
But she did, and she was like, hey, I've observed, right? She had observed this practice.
Yeah.
That was wonderful.
And she had had smallpox and she felt that it really ruined her looks. So she didn't want her children to have to experience this. And, you know, also the risk of dying. But the fear of being disfigured was a big part of smallpox too. I mean, it was, the death rates were really high. I mean, 20 to 30%, which is, you know, death rate for COVID is like 1% or something. So don't quote me on that, but I think that's right. So, I mean, the death rate was very high, but also if you had smallpox, you would be disfigured for life. You could be blinded. But you would certainly have, you know, pock marks, and particularly for someone like her, who as an aristocratic woman, a lot of her value in society was her looks. Mm-hmm. And she was considered a great beauty. And after she had smallpox, you know, she lost her, her eyebrows and her eyelashes and I assume had pock marks and felt that her looks were ruined. And she didn't want that to happen to her daughter.
Yeah, her story was really fascinating. And really all of the discussion of smallpox and the different therapies that were tried. I think earlier you were talking about with Queen Elizabeth, the red room therapy, or surrounding yourself with red flannel, or that red would somehow excise the disease.
Draw it out. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of principle of like attracts like. That it would dry out the pox if you had something red surrounding you.
I want to go to kind of this idea that it's sort of a dichotomy that's set up throughout the text of the scientist as either villain or hero. And I was thinking about Harry Harlow, who did more psychological experiments. Much of what we've been talking about is like biomedical, but he's a really interesting case. And I would love to hear more about, there were benefits, it seems, based on what I read from what he discovered, but also like he went really far. and I think as you suggest that he was maybe a bit too guided by his own subjective need to prove something.
Yeah, Harlow is a really interesting case because in the past few decades, he's certainly been classified as, you know, a real villain, and particularly because he used, not only did he use monkeys, but he used baby monkeys. Mm-hmm. And he did really, you know, his kind of final experiments. And I know John Gluck, his former student who has written about these, and John, I know, feels, you know, feels really bad to have participated in these experiments. But as he said at the time, it was like, that was what you did. You were part of the lab. You went in there and there were these baby monkeys at the bottom of, you know, the pits of despair. And you couldn't handle them. You couldn't do anything. And it was just part of your kind of training as a student that you would be part of these experiments. And the expectation was that you would get publications out of it. You would get things to advance your career. And you were kind of trained not to think about what the other implications were, that this was, that the animals were just instruments. Kind of like, you know, the autoclave or something. They were just instruments in the experiment. So, and I think Harlow kind of, yeah, took that farther than once people started thinking about it, which was quite a while after he did these experiments, were kind of, no, you can't just do that. That's really cruel. And particularly psychologically cruel. I mean, mm-hmm. the things with the mothers, you know, mm-hmm. Kind of the mothers with spikes and the mothers with who were cold and the mothers who blasted cold air on the babies. And yes, this made the babies really psycho. And you know, you're thinking that, well, duh. But at the time, in the 50s particularly, there was all kinds of discussions about overprotective mothers, and that, as I was saying with Harlow, I think in the 50s and before, and I gave the example, I think, of little Albert and in the 20s, that children had to be conditioned, but also that if mothers were too, what were called, you know, smothering, mothers were too affectionate, that would adversely affect children's development. That you had to let babies cry. Dr. Spock famously said that. That you couldn't, you just couldn't be too, show too much overt affection to children, because they would be ruined. They would be spoiled. There was this kind of, I was thinking of the kind of monster mother in The Manchurian Candidate, if you've seen that movie, mm-hmm. where Angela Lansbury plays Lawrence Harvey's mother, and she's just, you know, this evil, manipulative mother. But that was kind of, in some ways, the model of the evil mother in the 50s, that if you were too motherly, if you would create these psychotic children. And of course, what Harlow is showing is that if you're not motherly, you create psychotic children. So that was kind of a good thing, that yes, children really do need affection. And actually showing that on primates inadvertently also showed that primates feel these emotions as much as humans do. So they were interesting experiments, very much of their time, I would say, in terms of having to show the effects of, you know, deprivation of affection. But I don't think they would pass most animal care news committees now. That kind of...
I hope they wouldn't. I hope we've progressed.
I know. And... yeah, and most people now look at them and it's like, God, that's awful. How could you do this to these poor animals? To the mothers and to the babies. I mean, to make kind of psycho mothers and psycho babies by doing this, you know, sensory deprivation of affection experiments, which just seem really unspeakably cruel now.
And I was so fascinated that you had talked with John Gluck. Was that his name?
Yeah.
He was a student of Harlow's?
Yes. Yeah.
And does he have any kind of like residual trauma from this as well? I mean, it just seemed like a very...
Well, he wrote several articles, and he's written a book actually about his kind of recognition after the fact that these were morally indefensible experiments. So yeah, I think he does have a lot of remorse about this.
And so interesting, I was thinking about just an anecdote that I was talking to someone whose spouse works at the New Iberia Research Facility, which is just down the road from me. And he was just saying how loud it is and how it really will drive you. You feel like you're going to go mad because the conditions are just so loud. But thinking about Harlow and, you know, the use of primates in research, he developed a breeding facility too, right? Okay, because that was, again, going back to where do you actually source these research subjects from? You were saying that a lot, especially the rhesus macaque, which is a common primate used in research. It was originally imported from southern India, but of course the numbers got so low that I guess there was a need to create breeding sites here.
And most of the breeding facilities now for primates are in China, which has, I hear a cat.
Is that a hairball? We told you guys, it's the Animal Studies channel. There's going to be animal noise. Your cat does not like that breeding facility discussion about primates. Poor baby.
Anyways, most monkeys, research monkeys now come from China, like many other things. And one of the effects of COVID was actually a shortage of monkeys, primates used in research because China stopped exporting them in 2020. And I have never been to one of their breeding facilities, but they're immense. There were like 10,000 monkeys in one facility. And as some people have pointed out, China has a lot fewer restrictions on animal use in science than most other countries. And so, but these monkeys are, you know, go all over the world. And I think most people don't even realize where they come from. And they've been replaced by monkeys that are actually captured in the wild in Cambodia and other places. The nuts, rhesus macaques, and also another related species called Cynomolgus macaques. Just in case you wondered where they came from, they're mostly not bred here now. They're mostly imported.
Wow. Yeah, and just thinking, that was one thing is reading this book is just like, where do you actually get the research subjects? And that was no matter which century it was, that was just a persistent question. And it made me think about this fascinating, expensive rat or three rats. You talk about, this is in the last chapter, how for sale in, I guess, research catalogs, which I didn't know exist, but of course they would, I guess, between $17,000 and like $36,000, you can get a, you know, genetically modified or made rat to then start your own breeding in your lab. Yeah. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. For those in particular. Yeah. But you can also just order kind of custom bred mice and rats that are genetically modified, but the germline isn't modified, so they wouldn't necessarily breed rats that are like them. These, the ones that are so expensive are actually modified so that they will give birth to rats like them. But you can also just order, you know, I don't know, 100 knockout rats or whatever that have, you know, particular genes knocked out, so that they respond in certain ways and so forth. The custom-made rats and mice is a big industry.
That was one fascinating through line from Descartes to the present of thinking about the animal machine, beast machine. And I think you kind of address that with like, if we can truly manufacture in a way, they're just like little machines that we can use to test on. So that idea definitely still persists, even with our newest technology, which I guess is a good time to maybe talk about CRISPR, which is where the book ends up. So maybe just provide us a little overview of what that is. I'm sure many of us know, but just in case, and then how it has especially impacted experimentation.
So CRISPR, and I am totally not an expert on this, but it's it's a tool to edit genes. It enables to kind of a protein that enables you to go in and sort of remove a gene and put another one in its place. And it makes this relatively easy and inexpensive so that you can create genetically modified animals much more easily. And you can also genetically modify animals so that you can affect the germline. That is, you can basically create animals that will clone each other, that will breed other animals just like them. So you can affect the inheritance down the line.
Is this, will it reduce the amount of animals needed because it will reduce variability? And I don't know. I mean, possibly. Is this positive?
I don't know. It makes it easier to modify animals because at least to begin with when you started this idea of modifying, say, rats, it was by breeding. And so you would have to go through several generations. You would pick a variation that was useful, and then you would breed animals to express that variation. But it would take time. It would take several generations. And actually, some of the purpose-bred rats early in the 20th century, a couple of women were really responsible for that. There were some pretty well-known women who worked in these labs who were breeding rats. So CRISPR basically takes out the middleman, sort of, because you go right in and just change the gene. You don't have to go through this process of selective breeding. And so it makes it much easier to create these kind of custom-made animals. But also, in theory, it can make it, and this is part of the hype about CRISPR, is that you could change people mm-hmm. to eliminate certain diseases. You could breed people who don't have certain, genetic abnormalities. Say you could get rid of Down syndrome or other genetic diseases. Although, as I point out, some of the things that are, referred to as diseases, like, deafness or dwarfism, are not really diseases. That just brings up a whole other issue about disability and how we define it and the value of disabled people and so forth and so on. So it's like anything is something that could be fixed is what CRISPR kind of leads to, this idea that we can fix quote unquote defective people. And that makes it kind of ethically problematic, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And this is, something that's happened in the past decade. So I think we're still really, ethics takes a long time to catch up with practice in many cases. And in this case, I think ethics was caught totally flat-footed and has really not caught up with the science here.
I'm not quoting directly from the text, but one question or statement that you posed was, what do we do with all this knowledge that we've had? And I like what you said, like we're kind of caught, and this is kind of, I guess, to the ending point of where the book ends up about One Health, which I'll ask you to kind of describe that global movement in just a moment. But what I find so important about this book is that you're saying, hey, here is what we've done. Here is where we're coming from. The good, the bad, the ugly. And what are we going to continue to do as we gain more knowledge and we gain more tools. So the One Health organization, is it an organization?
Not really.
It's a movement.
It's a movement. It's kind of a set of ideas, I guess.
Okay. It seems like you're in support of that movement, possibly.
Yeah. Okay. So the idea of One Health is that human and animal health are intimately related, not only because, we use animals to find out about human health, but human and animal health actually are intimately intertwined, and that this in turn is intertwined with the health of the environment. So I think this is a really powerful idea. I think that animal and human medicine became separate basically starting in the 18th century when veterinary schools start to be founded in Europe, which is, in the 1750s. And really, and that was mainly for animals that were, that was for horses. It was for animals that were used in commerce in, it wasn't really for pets. So veterinary science changes over the course of the 19th century and the 20th century into something that is not very much related to human health. because it's animals that are, you know, companion animals. It's animals that we use in various ways. And I think bringing those two forms of medicine closer together will both give us greater awareness of how much we owe to animals in terms mm-hmm. of finding out about human diseases and other things, but also that human and animal health is really interrelated, that we get animal diseases, animals get human diseases, but also just in so many ways, and in terms of the health of the environment, how we treat animals, the ideas about animal health are really important, obviously. Well, obviously to me. So I think it's a really important way of thinking about our relationship with animals and with the world.
I love that. And before we wrap up and I ask you what you're currently working on, I'd like to just say that I think this book is foundational reading, I think, for anyone who's interested in that One Health movement or thinking more broadly from whatever discipline you come from. I'm coming from an English and poetry background. You can come from, I think, any discipline and really find something in here that will hopefully push us to be more considerate with our knowledge and how we use it. So thank you for writing this book. It's exciting.
Well, thank you. What I'm working on now, I'm really an early modernist, so I really work mainly on the period of kind of 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. And I'm working on a couple of things. I'm thinking about doing a biography of William Harvey, actually, for a series called Renaissance Lives. I haven't sent in my proposal yet, so it may not be accepted, but that's what I'm
thinking. If you say it, it might... That's good. You put it out there. So start doing it.
But I have a couple of other projects. One is about a history of the human skeleton, which includes how it's been displayed and used in museums in terms of human artifacts. And the other project, which is related to that, is about... that's going to sound really silly. It's about giants and how in the 16th and 17th century in particular, there was a lot of fossil bones were found that were thought to be the bones of human giants. They weren't. They were mostly the bones of like mammoths and things like that. But it fit into this whole kind of mythology that had been built up since the Middle Ages about that we all used to be giants, basically, that after the flood, Noah was a giant and he gave birth to generations of giants, but gradually we got smaller. So finding these bones then kind of supported that narrative. And
do we become smaller because of like moral failure?
Well,
like
that's not clear, but it's and it kind of gets very tangled up because then you start thinking about chronology. It's like, well, how long would it take for someone who is 30 feet tall to get 6 feet tall? How many generations? You know, it gets very tangled up. But just the kind of, I became really interested in kind of the stories that get attached to it because they're very much kind of national stories of national origins. And particularly in Europe, a lot of these giants are thought to be the Gauls. And there's this whole mythology of the Gauls, and not just in France, but everywhere.
That's wonderful. So
who were, yeah. Giant, even in Roman times, that Gaulish warriors were thought to be giants. And just how this kind of pans out and enters into the history of archaeology, the history of paleontology. It's not really until the 18th century that people start realizing that, no, these are not human bones. A, they're not human bones. B, they're really old. So they don't fit into the kind of current chronologies. And what does that mean?
Were they classified in museums as people ever?
Well, not one, not by the 18th century, no.
Okay.
Because people had a bit, but it's, yeah, it's because it's kind of, well, they look, I mean, some people are like, well, they look kind of like elephant bones, except nobody, very few people in Europe had actually seen an elephant at this point. So, you can, you know, so how do you, and then it's like, well, okay, if they're elephant bones, how did they get to France? Northern Germany. It's like, yeah, maybe they're not elephant, but well, I don't know. Are they giants? Are they not? And it just goes back and forth. And kind of the histories that are written, invented around these bones, I just find really fascinating.
Well, I think we have a future New Books Network interview. It's going to be three times coming back. I'm excited to follow that work. Again, you know, the human and the animal together, like animal bones mistaken for human. So all that overlap, and we're animals, right? Humans are animals.
Yeah. So yeah. And kind of the stories we make up to talk about our own histories, and to make them fit this physical evidence.
Well, Anita, it's been an absolute delight to have you here today. And everyone check out this book published with Johns Hopkins University Press, Experimenting with Humans and Animals from Aristotle to CRISPR. All right. Thank you so much, Anita.
Thank you, Callie. It's been really fun. Thanks a lot.